SBS Radio.
Wow.
We're on your side. If you have a go, you'll get a go.
Better hospitals over bigger banks.
Wow.
The insurgents were not rewarded.
We've lost the Prime Minister, but there is still a government to save.
I know you miss me. I know you want me back.
You're an international embarrassment.
Mr. Speaker, it's like Game of Thrones, but without all the good bits.
I think it's a joke. I know. Oh, careful there, honey.
It's all a big mess of dog's droppings, unless someone gets a shovel out.
See ya.
Hello, I'm Brett Mason in the gallery for SBS World News. This week, Scott Morrison and Bill Shorten return to work, kicking off this election year with near-identical funding pledges for Kakadu National Park, where the Prime Minister quickly ruled out an early March election.
Well, I'll announce the election date when I'm good and ready to do that. I've said there'll be a budget on the 2nd of April, and the maths after that aren't too hard to work out.
Before flying out to visit Vanuatu and Fiji.
It certainly carries its weight, doesn't it?
As part of his step up in the Pacific.
When you step up, you have to show up, you have to turn up, and that's what we're doing right here.
This week, we're taking a closer look at South Sudan, the world's newest nation. 5 years of civil war has seen more than 400,000 South Sudanese killed, close to 2 million displaced in their own country, and more than 2.4 million fleeing to neighbouring countries. Our first guest for 2019 is Francois Stamm, who's just finished his term as the head of the International Red Cross's 1,000-strong delegation based in the capital of South Sudan, Juba.
Francois, you've just returned from Juba. 2011, we saw South Sudan become the world's newest nation. There's been this civil war raging since 2013. What's the current situation given this power-sharing agreement that was reached in September, October last year? How likely is that, do you think, to hold?
Well, the current situation is actually very interesting. As you said, we've had this peace agreement signed in September between a number of parties, including, of course, the two main ones, the President Salva Kiir and the leader of the opposition, Riek Machar. So will it hold? I don't know. What I can tell you is that since this agreement was signed, even already a few months before that, we have noticed on the ground a significant reduction in the number of armed clashes between the government and the opposition. So this is good news. We still have incidents, we still have problems. Let's not forget that there are also other sources of armed violence in South Sudan, like cattle raiding, intercommunal violence, some criminality as well. So we could see a further delocalization, fragmentation of the violence, but hopefully the main conflict that has been active in the country since December 2013, as you mentioned, will be addressed, even though especially the international community is rather skeptical regarding this peace agreement, namely because the two main players are the same ones who failed to agree on power sharing previously. So, of course, that's a big question mark.
How difficult is it for the International Red Cross to operate in South Sudan, given those clashes and given the ongoing issues beyond the political conflict?
It is a very challenging context. Now, the ICRC, and here we're very fortunate, we have almost a 40-year track record in this country. And this is, for me, as an incoming head of delegation, I noticed immediately that was the thing I had to preserve at all costs, this reputation for efficient, but above all, independent humanitarian action. We've been present during the decades of struggle for independence, and of course, we've been present massively since the beginning of this internal conflict. So in this sense, we have good access, we have privileged access with the government, with all the parties. This is a context where we can, for instance, send a helicopter to medevac two wounded fighters from the opposition with the agreement of the government and take them to a hospital run by the ICRC, also in an area controlled by the opposition. And the government would allow you to do this, vice versa as well. So both parties of the conflict recognize that the ICRC has this unique role as a neutral, independent humanitarian actor to really help wounded soldiers get the health care they deserve. And this is something that is normal, that is natural, but that that unfortunately is getting lost in some conflict, like in Syria or other places, where some of the parties tend to now refuse that the wounded enemy get access to healthcare, which is something very disturbing for us as well. So it is, in this sense, we have good access. Now, South Sudan is a very challenging environment. Geography is difficult. There's a very important lack of infrastructure. It's a part of Africa that has been neglected for decades. You hardly have any roads. You have also regular cyclical seasonal flooding. Over half the country is flooded for 6 months of the year. So you need your own logistics. You need an air force almost. We have a lot of aircraft, helicopters. So it's a very costly operation, to be said. But things can be done. It's a very large operation of the ICRC. In logistical operational terms, it is the largest operation that the ICRC has in the world.
You talk about the political challenges. How hard is it to maintain that neutrality where you're trying to help people on both sides but also manage that very delicate political balance?
I think, again, because of the track record of the ICRC, because of what we have done for so many years, we can do it rather easily. People understand it's, you know, most stakeholders of the ICRC have met with the ICRC in a hospital, they have been visited in a prison, they have received assistance. So we have been part of this landscape for many years. But you know that the relationship between Juba and Western capitals or even the UN has been at times tense in the past. So for us it was very important, and we have succeeded so far, to remain above those political tensions and really to focus on our humanitarian work. And this has been well received by the parties.
We saw pretty incredible scenes in 2011 when that independence was achieved. There was so much excitement and hope. How difficult has it been for the many hundreds of thousands of South Sudanese who have been displaced, the hundreds of thousands who've been killed as a result of this civil war, to watch so quickly that independence sort of slip away into conflict?
Very difficult, very painful, very sad, actually, because, you know, this conflict, I think it's fair to say, is the result of a lack of an agreement between the Salva Kiir and Riek Machar on power sharing. And then, of course, it becomes quickly more complicated because you have tribal implications, Salva Kiir being a Dinka, Machar a Nuer, the two main tribes in South Sudan, so you have also tribal issues. But it's been very, very sad. And indeed, as you said, there was so much positive feeling, not only in South Sudan, but in the whole of Africa and the whole of the world regarding this new nation, and it has all collapsed rather quickly.
So you've spoken about a challenging environment politically and geographically. What is it that you see as the immediate priorities for the South Sudanese people? What are you trying to achieve there?
I think South Sudan, to be fair, is in need of everything. I mentioned the lack of development, the lack of infrastructure, but it all starts with peace. So I think so long as we don't have more stability, if we don't have maybe a return of some of the big development agencies that left the country, if we don't have some increased investment in the country, it will be very difficult for South to get better. And for us, this puts us in a difficult but interesting position, because it is now a protracted conflict that has been lasting for 5 years for this latest internal conflict. But just 2 years before that, you had decades of also armed struggle for independence. So it has had an impact on the lack of development, on the education. The level of education is extremely low. If you look at the World Development Indexes, South Sudan is always at the very bottom of them. I mean, together with Somalia and Central African Republic. So you have a lot to be done, but it all starts with peace. So I really hope that this fragile peace that we seem to be having now will hold, and then we can maybe look at more positive things.
One of the really heartbreaking things about what's happening in South Sudan is the impact it's having on women and children. About 85% of the displaced people from South Sudan are women and children.
Yes, you have very serious repeated violations of the most basic norms of international humanitarian law. The women and children suffer a lot. Civilians are often directly targeted. Villages are burned. The level of sexual violence is extremely high. And this is something we try to address by talking to the parties, talking to the combatants, telling them about the norms that need to be respected. But also, we of course help the victims. We help the women that have been the victims of sexual violence, medically and psychologically, but we try also in the villages with the communities to take measures so that they don't become victims in the first place. For instance, we try to make sure that you have a water well inside the village. We try to also rehabilitate the school so that people don't have to leave the village to go to school or to fetch water, which is during those movements that attacks usually take place. But it's still a major problem. Sexual violence in South Sudan is a massive problem.
How do you stop that? It's been going on for many, many years.
It has. I think you stop that, like, as I said, I mean, it needs development, it needs education. The level of education, I mentioned, you have between 10 and 15% of women in South Sudan that know how to read and write. It's one of the lowest rate in the world. So again, it needs everything, this country, but it needs to start with peace.
Is there much opportunity for women to play leadership roles politically or within communities in South Sudan? That's one of the things that in other African nations, for example, has been a real priority. Is there the same emphasis placed on that in South Sudan?
Yes, you have some very strong women, some very influential women who play a role politically. I think the new agreement, the new constitution, the new parliament, they have quotas for women, which is all welcome. Now, it is fair to say that in the traditional society in South Sudan, I mean, polygamy is still very common. If you're a man of wealth, I mean, you have many wives. So you still have also these issues. But what you said is correct. I mean, there are some very strong women, some very strong voices. A weakness of South Sudan is, in my view, that what we would understand as civil society is not very strongly developed yet.
When people perhaps look at South Sudan, the situation is just so overwhelmingly sad that it's difficult to find much inspiration or hope for the nation's future. Why are you optimistic about South Sudan's future?
Well, I'm reasonably optimistic. Reasonably optimistic. But again, if I was talking to you 1 year ago, I would have told you very different stories of massive military offensive, massive displacement, burned villages, refugees going out of South Sudan. Now we talk about a peace agreement that has been signed that might work, might not work. Let's be frank about this. We're talking about possible return. So I think during the time I was there, I could see this change, and we could also see the change in the field, on the ground, with less fighting, with people somehow getting back together. So all this is still very fragile. I think 2019 will be a very interesting year in South Sudan, because either it sticks or, unfortunately, it doesn't. And as the ICRC, we have to be ready for any possible scenario.
Australia has been in South Sudan in terms of contributing Defence Force personnel to the United Nations mission in South Sudan. Since 2011, since independence, we've spent a lot of money in terms of aid development, about $50 million or so in the last 2 years alone. Has that been a good investment? Has that money made a big difference in South Sudan, like a demonstrable difference?
Well, for us, let me say that Australia has also been very generous for the ICRC, and we're very grateful for this support. I mean, it has been a very strong and reliable donor for many years, including for South Sudan. Now, to answer your question, if you look at the situation in South Sudan, I mean, one has to say that it's not working very well. But still, I think the ICRC, the UN agencies, many NGOs have very large programs. So I think it's fair to say that without this investment, the situation would be even much, much worse for the civilian population. You mentioned security. You have now with UNMISS, the world's largest peacekeeping operation. Again, the overall situation is not good, but it makes a difference. It makes an impact.
You sort of talk about this being a almost do or die year for South Sudan. What can countries like Australia do to help that process?
I think to follow the file, to follow the development in Juba, in the country, and to try to be supportive but also realistic as to the demands that will be put to the international community, but maybe to demonstrate a strong interest. You know, it's been hard in South Sudan, because despite the scale of the problem, despite the suffering, it is true that one doesn't speak a lot about this country, be it in Australia or in Western Europe or in the US. And I think this is maybe related to the fact that you don't have, for instance, radical Islam, you don't have black flags flying over the South Sudan. You've all heard the terrible attack in Nairobi just 2 days ago. I mean, these things do not happen in South Sudan, but they, if they were, of course, it would raise the profile of the country in some capital. Same thing with migration. You don't have migrants, refugees from South Sudan reaching Europe or Australia. You have, of course, South Sudanese in Australia, but they usually arrive during the struggle for independence, not during the most recent conflict. So again, a migration issue would raise the profile of the country. So it's really a neglected part of Africa, but for us it's really the humanitarian imperative. And of course, as the ICRC, we don't need anything else, but it needs to be, when you look in the field, when you look at the suffering, when you look at the displacement, you really feel something must be done.
How would you rate the scale of the humanitarian crisis compared to the ones we see in the media all of the time? I mean, there are obviously a lot of very worthy causes in other countries, but this one, as you say, it is very, very large, and it's one that we don't often talk about here in Australia.
I would raise it right up to the top. I mean, it's really, in terms of suffering, in terms of numbers, in terms of impact, if you look at the number of persons in the country that are directly affected and seriously affected, it's really all the way to the top.
You've just now left Juba. You were running a group of around 1,000 Red Cross workers there.
Yes.
For you, is it difficult to leave at such a critical
yes,
time?
Yes, it was. It's a great team. It's a large team. You mentioned we have 800 resident staff, South Sudanese. We have 200 international staff, quite a few Australians, by the way. So it's a great and diverse team. It was, in terms of management, it was a big challenge, but very stimulating, very motivating. And of course, you, South Sudan doesn't leave you intact. You leave something of, I mean, you leave a part of yourself there. It's because, you know, it's very operational. You do things. You have planes, you have trucks, you have you have hospitals, you have surgery. So it's very visual as well, and it's very strong. It's good.
In what ways did that exposure to the South Sudanese culture impact you? What were some of your, I guess, on a personal level, emotional moments or connections with South Sudan?
I think maybe when you look at a war surgery facility, I mean, what these people, the surgeons, do, it's a miracle, really. Especially, of course, the wounded children. I mean, it's a cliche, but it's still very powerful when you see a wounded child that has to go through an amputation, for instance, but whose life can be saved. This is very strong. But your question is interesting, because one of my regrets is also the fact that because of the conditions, because of the security, you cannot really go and meet the people. You know, you have curfews, you have limitations. Of course, you look very different physically, so you can't really mingle and engage with the South Sudanese society. And this is a regret as far as I'm concerned. So I really hope that in a few years, maybe I can go back and have a better interaction.
War and conflict has dominated the first decade of South Sudan's existence. In 10 years, in its second decade, what do you hope the future holds for South Sudan?
Well, I really hope it's peace. I mean, South Sudan, okay, it's not a very rich nation, but it could very, very easily feed itself. I mean, there's a potential for agriculture. You have oil, which is also part of the problem, but now oil is hopefully part of the solution, because Sudan also has a strong interest in increased stability for South Sudan, because they do benefit from the transit of oil from South Sudan through Sudan for export. So I really hope that South Sudan becomes a normal country. This is really my hope for South Sudan.
We all have that hope. Francois Stamm, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
SBS acknowledges the Ngunnawal people, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which the Australian Parliament sits and where this program was recorded. We pay respect to the elders of the Ngunnawal Nation, both past and present.
SBS.com.au